Greetings and salutations. This is Tony from the Agile Revolution, and this is Craig.
Hello, Tony.
And with us today, we have Jez Humble.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Jez, we've been following you around, I think, for about 17 conferences now. And
chasing you with a microphone.
Pleading with you to come and talk to us.
Just the last 17.
Wow. That's it. We backed you into a corner this time.
And we literally have got him in the corner.
That's actually true. Yes. Yeah. Well done.
Yeah, good to see you. Welcome back again. I think you're second or third Agile Australia?
Yeah, I was at, I think, the first one or the second one, and then I was back 2 years ago. And Rachel puts on a great show, so it's always a pleasure to come.
Excellent. So I guess a lot of things, a lot of water under the bridge since we've last seen you. You're now doing a lot of interesting stuff, or even more so in the DevOps field and that whole lean enterprise. And I think the last time we saw you out here, you were sort of out here talking about the lean enterprise book, and the time before that was the continuous delivery book, and since then the awesome Accelerate book that's come out as well.
Thanks.
Yeah. How's all that been going? How's the reaction to particularly that book? Because that's an interesting book for practice.
Yeah, I mean, and it's an interesting book for us to write as well, because obviously most of my books are kind of very based on industry experience. This one is obviously based on a research program. Dr. Nicole Forsgren, the principal investigator of that research program, is formerly a recovering academic. I think she would probably be okay with describing herself as. And so it's based on research. We've taken a bunch of practices that kind of lean and agile people think are, you know, obvious and clear, and we've actually tried to validate those and see the impact on organizations, on their delivery performance, on their organizational performance, and that's been a really interesting exercise. And people have been really into it, actually. We've had a lot of people say how helpful it's been and how valuable it's been to helping them and helping them convince other people, particularly. And that's been obviously hugely gratifying for us.
That's the question for me, Jez, because, you know, when I talk to practitioners, that stuff makes sense, right? It makes sense to all of us. But it's the actual factor of being that sticky marshmallow layer that of leadership is convincing them that this is the right way to go. How is this impacting on that? Because some of the stuff that was in there is the things that I think they need to hear.
Yeah. And that was kind of our goal, really, is to give you something kind of short and concise and clear where you could give it to people and they could read it and be like, oh, okay, now I see this, and to be very principle-based. So that was definitely the goal. I guess the proof will be in the pudding.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still scary because, I mean, as a consultant, I'm going to many different organizations and I'm still seeing dev, ops.
Yeah.
The diagram you drew today made me cry.
Oh, sorry about that. I was aiming for tears of laughter, but obviously went a bit wrong.
Because it was so true. It was like, no, I'm still seeing this.
Yeah, you know, I've become a bit of a grumpy old man over time, and you know, we still see people outsourcing testing, and we still see people outsourcing IT ops, and you know, TDD, as we saw this morning in the keynote. I asked who's doing TDD. That's a very small proportion.
Yeah, that made me cry.
Yeah. Yeah. So you know, a lot of these things that we know clearly. I mean, in the case of outsourcing testing, we know that's terrible. We've all known it's terrible for ages. All these things we've been talking about for years, like cross-functional teams, it's as if the world is kind of divided into two. There's people for whom that's obvious, and why wouldn't you do that? And there's people for whom, like, there's organizations for whom, like, you know, you know that'll probably never happen. You know, hell will freeze over before they decide they're going to have build cross-functional teams. And it is incredibly frustrating. I share your frustration, I think, with that.
But I think the interesting thing is that there's a couple of things. The fact that you've been able to put a number on these things speaks to two things. One, it speaks to those people that you're trying to, you know, either on stage, you're able to say that this was 23 times faster or those type of things. But secondly, it also proves that all the people who say, we can't measure what we do, well, not only have you measured what people do, but you've actually also been able to compare it in an environment where people go, well, we can't do the same project twice. We actually can find metrics that can give us meaningful insights.
Yeah, I think that for me is huge. For a long time, we've struggled in the software industry to actually apply science to what we're doing. You can't do randomized controlled experiments. It's incredibly hard to do randomized controlled experiments. The ones that have been done have typically been done with students in an academic setting with small sample sizes that don't necessarily generalize. And I think what I'm very proud of is just having been a part of that project that Nicole put in place of applying behavioral science to our field, and it's yielded like really powerful results, which I think is quite revolutionary. And I'd love to see more people weigh into this and start replicating these results and extending them. We've only covered the part of the value stream that goes from development through to production. It'd be great to see people apply the same techniques to studying things like product management. So I think there's enormous scope for using this approach and extending it, and I'd love to see this be the beginning of the journey.
Yeah. What's the early feedback been like from that?
It's been great, honestly. People have been really, really enthusiastic and happy about it, with some exceptions. I mean, there's this kind of general trend sometimes that you see with people poo-pooing the social sciences and saying, well, you know, it's surveys, you can't trust that. And that was the reason we devoted a whole section of the book to actually explaining the methodology. Nicole went into a lot of detail on how those surveys are run and why you can trust the data. And, you know, my background, my undergraduate degree was in physics. So obviously, you know, I come from a scientific background. And, you know, there's always been this thing about social sciences. And, you know, you go to CERN and look at the work that CERN is doing, no one's actually detecting a Higgs boson. You're getting a bunch of readings in sensors from which you can infer, based on theory, that a Higgs boson existed for a, you know, tiny fraction of a nanosecond and then disintegrated into a bunch of other particles which produce these readings in sensors. So, you know, the idea that, you know, you can see cause and effect in hard science is crap. You know, we know this is nonsense. And then on the other side, you see the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, Thinking Fast and Slow, behavioral science, the application of those techniques to economics, and they won a Nobel Prize for that. So, you know, the idea that you can't measure psychological stuff is false. It works. We know it works. We've applied it to many other fields. We can apply it here. It's fine. But you do occasionally, you know, I see the occasional review go up where it's like, this is bullshit. And you're just like, oh, you know, obviously some kind of contrarian. But, you know, trying to let it get you.
Yeah. Have you seen people then actually, I guess, replicating that or coming back and, you know, sort of saying that, yeah, we've applied the same sort of, you know, formula or survey to our own work?
Yeah, I mean, one of the interesting results, we obviously spent a bunch of time looking at culture and measuring culture, and one of the gratifying things that we did is we looked at a study Google had done, Project Aristotle study, which is pretty well known, finding that the key factor in building high-performing teams was psychological safety. We actually took some of our results and asked the questions that based on Google's research, and were able to replicate those results in our own in our own study. So culture, which is perhaps, you know, the squishiest and least tangible of all the things we measure, is the one thing where we've been able to actually replicate the results rather nicely and get some good agreement. So I think that was great, and it also, I think, validates the approach that we've taken.
In fact, I think that was probably my one takeout from your talk today, because, you know, I've seen earlier versions of this, of the things in this talk, but the one thing that I had, I've just recently been having trouble trying to get through to leaders, the Project Aristotle triangle, and the, you know, the same thing. Oh, that's garbage. How would that ever work? And the fact that you've been able to match it back to the approach you were using, the culture approach you chose, the methodology, is very interesting. So I'm going to go on. Yeah, that's now been my homework to go on. Yeah, do a bit more research into into that. Maybe go read the book as well.
Yeah, read the book as well.
Yeah.
Have you got a copy? You better get signed.
Yeah, not with me.
Yeah, the other thing, I think when you do come across these teams that are actually functioning well in this, though, so I recently walked into a company where they've got a great team. There's a particular person who's driven this, and the culture is just fantastic. They actually have the ability to press the button and go to prod every day.
Oh, that's great.
But they don't. And they can't because of the change process.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the other one that was my takeout from you today. You know, that how do we affect that change process? And the information that you were supplying there is, yeah, this is the stuff that we need to affect it, because it is the old world change method and the PMO holding onto their phase gates.
Right.
Which is crippling these you know, when you have that ability to go to production, why would you not do that?
Yeah, and that's very common. And we actually, in 2019, we have revisited that. We looked at change management and lightweight approaches to change management back in 2014, the very first year we did this. We looked at it again this year, and so there'll be some interesting results coming out when data DataDevOps report comes out this year when we look at that. So yeah, it's absolutely possible to take a lightweight approach. That approach is totally compatible with ITIL. ITIL talks about standard changes and using just-in-time validations rather than, you know, a monthly change control board meeting as a way of approval. So, you know, it's not even that we know that it works. It's that we know that it works, and it's compliant with ITIL. And we know many organizations that are highly regulated that use these alternative implementations of controls, such as segregation of duties. So, you know, there's really no reason not to do it apart from fear. And fear is a great reason. Like, I understand that. But you've got to move with the times.
Yeah, and I think we were lucky, Craig and I, to grow up in a company that really did invest a lot of time and effort into that. And when we were there, it was going well. I think, you know, there were areas that were able to do that. And, you know, the other thing was taking change. The other thing with change that I talk to people about is taking the change guys and integrating them with the programs at work and bringing them closer to the mix. So they're actually seeing the mechanism, because they become your advocate then. And we had a lot of success with that. We actually joined the change people with the Agile coaching team.
Oh, that's great.
And and risk as well. So we had risk, change, and Agile coaching all together. And the change for the organization was huge.
And the focus on building quality in, which you alluded to in the talk that drove a whole bunch of things down on the ground, including the video you often reference in your talks. But that was a thing that we found on our original journey, was that we were doing the water scrum fall so to speak, but really found that the testing was our bottleneck. And and originally it was like, go fix automated testing, but actually no, we actually had to go back and go to grassroots and realize that even testers weren't performing as testers. They were just subject matter experts thumping a keyboard. So we had to go right back to core roots of quality and helping people learn about proper testing results.
I think that's great. And I mean, my question to you is, what was it about that environment or your teams or whatever that enabled you to actually do that, do you think?
I think firstly is we had a really good leader, and you can't dismiss that. We had in Jeff Smith, who was he was in that particular period of time, was very avant about, we're going to do this, and he gave us that capability to make it happen.
Yeah.
And because we had a leader who said, it's okay to go this way.
Yeah.
Everybody bought in and started to go that way, and then our job became, wasn't easier, but, you know, we got a lot of emphasis on what we were able to do. Do you agree on that?
Yeah, and made it okay to experiment and try things. And so, you know, for the time in that organisation, there were lots of things in a financial institution that just weren't happening, in that part of the world, things like bring your own device and automated testing and on the mainframe and all sorts of things that you wouldn't have normally probably been able to do. So that, that ability to go and try something new and fix a problem.
Yeah.
Particularly for the late 2000s when we were doing that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you talked about the fact you were able to go and get the change team to come and work with the coaches and work with the teams. Like, I mean, it sounds so simple. Get people who are trying to have a shared goal and get them to, like, work together with each other. Sounds so obvious, but it's really hard in real life in many places. Or you find, I don't know if it's hard, but the people have a psychological block about it almost.
Yeah, and it goes back to that psychological safety stuff as well. I think, there's a fear, like you said, help, but it's an unhealthy fear in that instance that, if I do this, then I'm going to do something wrong, and then I'm going to be the one that they're going to hang out to dry.
Right.
And so the fear factor just goes, okay, well, we'll put all these command and control checks over this to make sure that when someone comes and says, I did the wrong thing, well, no, I didn't. I ticked all those dot point boxes off.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
And in the long run, it still failed.
Yeah, but at least it wasn't me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or it was Bob.
It was actually talking today about cloud, I really sort of liked that. You can put that in, but it doesn't make any difference because you're just doing the same thing you were doing on your in-premise stuff. And I hadn't really sort of thought about those measures as much. But you spoke about in previous talks I've seen about the work that you did with the U.S. government in trying to move that cloud strategy. I mean, behind the scenes, that must have been a lot of, you know, a lot of frustration in the early parts, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, I joined that team when they were already 6 months into doing that, so I didn't really see the kind of the growing pains that they had right at the beginning trying to get it started. But by the time I joined, you know, they had this prototype that they were building, and you know, it took a year to build a prototype, and then it took another year to take it through the risk management process in government. But like, it was actually really interesting. Fascinating process. It was this really small team. There was about 10 of us, really, but who built this platform as a service. So, you know, by big company standards, a team of 10 building a platform as a service is crazy. But I think it's one of these things, again, where, you know, having more people doesn't necessarily make things better. So just having a very highly motivated team of 10 people building this thing, it was really great to have been a small part of that. And going through the it took another year to go through the compliance process. That was really interesting as well, just in terms of the interactions, working with people who weren't used to a platform that was designed in this way, that was designed around the principles of continuous delivery. A lot of interesting stuff came out of that. The one regret I have about that is you have to produce all this documentation for a US federal government system where you describe how you've implemented all the controls that you have to implement, 325 mm-hmm. controls for a moderate impact government information system. We really wanted to make that documentation live so other people could see how we'd met those controls. But unfortunately, those system security packages, as they're called, uncontrolled classified information. So we weren't able to make them public, and I'm kind of really bummed about that. I will say, if you are a local, state, or federal government agency in the US, you can go and access the FedRAMP package and download the package and see what it is we did. But yeah, that was a fascinating process. And for me, the fact that we were able to do it, I think is a testament not just to the team, but also to the fact that there is a lot of flexibility in real life about how these controls are implemented. Like, no one disagrees about the control objectives. We want to make sure that our systems are safe and that people's data is safe. And we're all trying to do the same thing. We're not trying to, you know, bypass any of that. It's just about finding better ways to achieve those control objectives that don't slow things down.
Mm. Yeah.
So one question I wanted to ask you, and Craig alluded to it before, because I was sitting in the back, and when you asked if people were doing TDD, I was a little stunned. And, you know, and then I was thinking about it, and, you know, the more organisations, I'm not seeing it. And it was a sort of a lightning. Why do you think that is, and what do we need to do to make that happen?
I think I learned TDD by working on a team at ThoughtWorks back in 2005. With a bunch of just incredible people. Nat Price, who wrote the Growing Objects Oriented Software Guided by Tests book, a bunch of other people who were very big in the early Agile movement. So I was the only person on the team who didn't know how to work in that way, and I got brainwashed. And a lot of the other people I know who picked it up, they got brainwashed too. Mm-hmm. And I just think unless you actually spend weeks or months doing it, it's very hard to get into. I actually teach a class at UC Berkeley where I brainwash people in TDD. We have a whole series of simple exercises we go through, and everyone starts test first. And that's, I think, the shortest amount of time it's possible to get people really into the idea of TDD. And that's like a week-long course. It's part of the class that ThoughtWorks used to teach. I don't know if they still teach to new graduate hires called Object Bootcamp in the day. Which was, hey Rebecca, who was it who taught Object Bootcamp?
Fred George,
thank you. Yeah, it was Fred George who came up with Object Bootcamp. Thanks very much, Rebecca. So I've got this Rebecca Parsons, CTO of ThoughtWorks.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Who's guest starring on the podcast?
That's yeah. Right, guest starring on the podcast.
Go through the archives, you'll find her.
Yep, we've had Rebecca on.
So that's great. But the interesting thing about that class is it's not just teaching TDD; it's also teaching good object-oriented design, and those kind of things go hand in hand. And I think maybe that's a part of it. Like, you can't really grok TDD without also grokking good design and how to build codes in an incremental, iterative way. And that's a lot of stuff. It's a complete conceptual change to the way you think about how you build software. And that's, I think, you know, it's just a lot.
Yeah, it comes back to that. You know, I always think of that original XP diagram in Kent Beck's book, which had all the arrows pointing to all the things that, you know, essentially had a relationship to each other. And, you know, you really cherry-picking things is what people tend to do. And and TDD is probably the easiest one. If you don't cherry-pick it, well, then I have all these other problems that I don't have to deal with. But actually, you haven't solved any of the problems you had in the first place by not doing it.
Right. Yeah, and there's this misconception that TDD is about tests when it's actually about design. And design is so central to everything else, and it ties into all these other things like, you know, refactoring and so forth. And so I think it's just a lot more disruptive than people think, maybe.
You mentioned ThoughtWorks before. You were sort of there, I guess, in what we call in the golden age, and we've had others on the podcast over the years that we've talked about. But that must have been because I think about all the things that followed through, particularly, you know, I guess starting with the continuous delivery book with Dave Farley. But I mean, that must have been a golden age to sort of set you up for where you are now.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, all of the ideas that I think went into the continuous delivery book just came out of what people were doing on projects at ThoughtWorks at the time. And that was part of a wider community as well. I don't want to claim that it was just ThoughtWorks. There was a whole bunch of overlapping communities, the Extreme Tuesday Club in London. There was people who worked on the early projects, the early Agile projects, like the Connextra project, and so forth. So there's like all these overlapping communities in London at the time working on different things. And, you know, I never went to Extreme Tuesday Club, but people I worked with did. And so there was this kind of great melting pot of ideas at the time. And it just felt normal. It felt like this is the way you do software. And then it's kind of quite weird and alienating when you go into the wider world and people just look at you like you're kind of a bug-eyed lunatic.
Yeah.
And you have to remind yourself, oh, no, that I'm not a lunatic. This is actually okay. You know, I have this discussion time and time again about trunk-based development. You know, it's still super controversial today. The world is divided into people who think that trunk-based development is obvious and people who think that it's insane and it can't possibly work. And when you're with people who think it's insane, can't possibly work, I constantly have to remind myself that I'm not actually crazy. And so that can be a bit weird sometimes. But yeah, I mean, definitely having been part of that at that time, you know, it's impossible to overstate the impact of having been a part of that community.
Mm-hmm. I think back across that history, you know, we mentioned the CD book, but you know, the Lean Enterprise book, yeah. and now your more recent books around DevOps including the surveys as well. One of the things is that you have this knack of taking the hard things and putting them in a way for folks to really digest it, but without in a way of pushing a methodology or a framework down their throat. What do you think the secret is behind that?
Yeah, thank you. it's really difficult because you want to persuade people in a way that gives them ownership. Gives them ownership and control. I've seen so many organizations where, you know, we're going to implement Agile by rigidly following this methodology. And you're like, oh my God, you know, how obviously ironic and disastrous that is. And so, you know, that really motivated me to not do that. And, you know, there's this quote from the early days of Toyota, which really stuck with me, where I think it was, I can't remember which of the Toyota family it was, but someone had stolen the plans for their loom, and someone asked him, "What are you going to do?" And he's like, "Well, you know, the thieves who stole the plans, they have not got the experience that we have had by trying and failing and learning, and so they're not going to be able to move as fast as us." And I think, you know, you've got to work it out for yourself. I mean, the books hopefully will help inspire people and give people ideas, but you know that doesn't replace trying and experimenting. So I always try and focus on trying to inspire people, not telling them what to do, but like, here's some ideas, here's how it all fits together, go and work it out for yourself, you know, not in a mean way, but in a way that hopefully encourages people to try things out. And I think that's the best you can do.
And thank you for that, because as a practitioner, you know, when you walk in and, you know, big scaling framework is on the table here, it's nice to be able to throw like the Lean Enterprise book on the table and go, I'm gonna have a read of that and we'll talk on Monday.
does that work?
Sometimes.
I'll take it.
Depends on which level you're talking to. Like, typically the person who reads the book, it depends on, you know, who's already signed a contract up the line, I guess.
That's always a risk.
Yeah. But it certainly opens up the conversation. And even if they do choose big scaling framework, you know, over here on the left, you can at least start to have a conversation and go, well, actually how we do this. And it's okay if you even if you start with that thing, but let's actually talk about the real issues. And so that's always been the good thing about the Lean Enterprise book, as well as the DevOps things more of late, has allowed me to do that. So thank you for that on behalf of the community.
Oh, thanks very much.
And I think it's an important thing that it's created a community. So that's notwithstanding the books, but it's created a community that you can reach out to. So if you're listening to this, you can reach out. I know that you can reach out to Jez. You can send him an email and he'll get back to you. My old organization did that. We ended up having him run a workshop for us, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And it was a cracking, good, fun day. So if you ever get that chance, take that. But the reality of that is that the community that is there at your fingertips. It's a very inclusive community that's happy to help you in any way.
Yeah, and I think this is what I love about the DevOps community is that there's so much focus in the DevOps community on empathy and on helping each other. It's a really lovely community. So I think it's definitely not just me. There's loads of people in the DevOps community there who are open and the reality is these are hard problems. We don't have the solutions. It's evolving, and anyone who's like this, the magic silver bullet, we know that's not true. So we're all in the same boat. And I think that's really what motivates it.
So just one last question. You mentioned, the DevOps, State of DevOps report is on its way in and one for edition for this year coming soon. But what sort of got your interest? What's next down the line, or what hard problems are you tackling now that you can give us some insight into?
Yeah, well, so DevOps Research and Assessment, the company that Nicole and I founded, got acquired by Google in December. So I'm now a Google employee, now working for Google Cloud as a developer advocate. So that's right.
Do no evil.
Yeah, well, I'm working on it. So very interested to be a part of Google and see what we can do there.
Excellent.
Fantastic.
Well, if people want to find out more about you and all the things that you do, where can they find that information?
I'm most active on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Jez Humble, all one word. Thanks very much for having me.
That's been fantastic. On behalf of the DevOps community, again, thank you. And I think it's really important that we have someone out there that actually is championing it. So don't stop.
So then we need to wrap this thing up, Tony.
No pressure.
So we have a little thing that we do to finish the day off, because we're the Agile Revolution. So we ask our people who are letting us interview them to join us in Viva la Revolution. So.
Because that's a little tagline.
Viva la Revolution.
That is. Viva la Revolution. That is it. So after three, one, two, three.
Viva la Revolution.
Thank you, Jez.
Thanks very much.